It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. I'm Kirk O'Bear and... Wait, there's somebody missing. Oh, that's right. Casey's not here today. So you're going to have to get 100% of your entertainment value strictly from me and not from Casey Hoff, which is okay because he usually plays the straight man and I try and mix him up a little bit. But for fans of our show that have been listening now for over 3 years on WHBL 1330 in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, we have good news for you. We are now broadcasting live all over the world by the internet, and we also have the ability for our listeners to download podcasts of past shows, and this show will be one of those that you can download. So if you'd rather listen to Kirk and Casey while you're walking your dog or jogging or whatever you may be doing, you have that luxury now. But just to remind you of that, you can go to any of the 16 stations that are part of the Midwest Communication Network. Our local one here in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, WHBL.com. And you can download episodes of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. I'm going to continue with the topic that we started on our last show, and that had to do with a significant ruling that recently occurred in the case of State versus Mark Jensen. And that was a case that involved Mr. Jensen being accused of murder, premeditated first degree intentional homicide of his wife. The twist in this case that actually was something that was litigated for years and years, but ultimately came down to the habeas corpus petition being granted in the Eastern District of Wisconsin just recently. It wound its way through the court system, and the intriguing thing about all of this is that a piece of evidence that was hotly litigated was allowed in, and ultimately the jury did convict Jensen of homicide, intentional homicide, premeditated. And this note, for those of you that aren't familiar with the case, was one where Mrs. Jensen, his wife, supposedly had written a note indicating that if someone were to find her dead, that it was her husband who did the killing, and that she feared for her life, and so on. Now, sure enough, about a week after that, Mrs. Jensen ends up dead, and Mr. Jensen is prosecuted for her murder based on an overdose of, I believe it was antifreeze that they found within her blood system and killed her. So the defense's theory in the case was that she wrote this so-called suicide note, or not suicide note, but note implicating him in a murder as part of a suicide gesture. And as I followed the case, that kind of made sense to me because we've seen that before where someone is committing suicide. If someone is in the planning out stages of that, oftentimes, it comes from a variety of sources. I'm sure sometimes it's because a person has an emotional need to relieve the pressures of life and so forth. But there are times when people do it out of anger or out of a mistrust of another person or the mistrust of themselves, whatever the case may be. And it appeared from the circumstances that this was one of those suicides that was done for whatever reason, but done in such a way so that it was designed to harm her husband in the maximum possible way. And that's what I believed based on the evidence that I saw. However, the prosecution wanted to use this particularly damning piece of evidence, if you want to call it that, in its case in chief, as evidence that it was premeditated and that she was aware of the fact that she was going to be killed. Now, there was litigation that occurred leading up to all of this, and eventually the court ruled, and I mean the trial court at the beginning of the process, ruled that the evidence would come in and that it can be used by the prosecution. There was an appeal that took place that went to the Court of Appeals. That court more or less sidestepped the issue and said, regardless of whether this note is admissible in evidence or not, we're going to find that it was harmless error because of the other evidence in the case. Judge Griesbach gets a hold of the case, and again, this is a habeas petition, the very last chance that you have as a criminal defendant to try and argue that there was some legal error in your case. And as you can imagine, oftentimes, most times, unsuccessful, because you're asking a higher level court to review something that's been reviewed several times before in the courts below, And it's really just another look at it. But, of course, when you're arguing that someone's freedom is at stake here and that someone's been wrongfully convicted of something, of course, the habeas courts will take a very serious look at it. What happened was Judge Griesbach found that this could not have been a harmless error and that the decisions below were really just a number of justifications to try and keep the conviction intact and not upset the conviction. And, you know, if Casey were here, we could argue this point, but I'm just going to have to argue it alone since he isn't. But the thing that's interesting to me about that is that we find so often in these appellate processes an unwillingness for the courts to really look at the evidence for what it is. We do have a tendency, and Judge Griesbach hit it on the head when he said that the courts below in this Jensen case have utilized the opinions as a way to just justify another result. And who is to say what the effect of not having this piece of evidence come in would be? So let's talk about that for a little bit more, because people don't seem to be understanding the significance of keeping evidence out and what that's all about. So, in fact, I saw George Stephanopoulos on the Today Show, or Good Morning America, rather, earlier this week, trying to talk about this case, and he wasn't making a whole lot of sense because he was taking the approach that how could you possibly keep a note from the grave out of evidence when it seems to directly implicate the husband? Well, the answer is this. There is no opportunity to cross-examine a note, a piece of paper. And that's what we call hearsay. Everybody agrees that hearsay under most circumstances should not be admitted into evidence because there's no opportunity to challenge or seek the truth. And see, that's what we're seeking in our entire criminal justice process, or for that matter, even in civil cases. We want to explore the evidence, be able to examine it from all sides, be able to poke it, if you want to look at it that way. But you can't do that with a piece of paper because it just says what it says. There's no opportunity to find out the motivation behind it, the reasoning behind it, and things are said, or in this case, written, for all kinds of reasons. Some of them are based on the reason that it might be, but it could be something else. And so here's the point. If, in fact, this letter was written as I believed, and, you know, no disrespect for the families involved with all this, because I know it's been many, many years worth of trauma, essentially, that they've had to go through. But all I'm saying is that the defense in this case made sense to me because it was something that I could see being logical under the circumstances. But let's just say, for example, that that note was written by Mrs. Jensen so that her husband would be tried and convicted of murder, and that she went on and committed suicide just to have that way of speaking from the grave, if you will. When all of that happened, you can't bring out your theory of defense as to why that may be true by exposing different facets of the creation of that piece of evidence. So even if it's something that you'd want to help your side of the case, you can't do that because the person who wrote the note just isn't there. So that's what people are missing when I hear the commentary. And of course, this is drawn national news, a case right here out of Wisconsin, is that the problem with admitting something of this nature, and, you know, at first blush you might say, duh, it's a letter that says her husband's going to kill her, so why wouldn't that be relevant at trial? Well, you know, again, you have to take a step back and realize that the goal of having a trial is to find facts and to explore them from all different angles to the maximum extent possible. So this is bad for both sides in terms of letting this in. Now, what happened was, when it did come in, it was the judge in the original case made his ruling primarily based on what we call a forfeiture by wrongdoing ruling. And what that means is that if the reason that a witness is unavailable, and if the unavailability of that witness is why it becomes hearsay, well, then you can't claim a hearsay objection if you are the reason why that person is unavailable. That's a long way of saying if you kill your wife, you can't object to the note she wrote coming into evidence because you're the one that killed her. And that's why it's hearsay and why she's not saying what happened. which is kind of an odd logical ring when you go in circles, because if none of that were true, if in fact you weren't responsible for your wife's death, then there wouldn't be a trial. You wouldn't be on trial for murder. So it's just kind of an odd little twist on how some of these cases are applied. And the full effect of this is yet to be seen, because after all, this doesn't mean that Mark Jensen is innocent. It doesn't mean he's not guilty. What it means is that his first conviction has been reversed, and the state now has the opportunity, and we shall see if they take that opportunity, to retry Mark Jensen without the use of this note from the grave. So we'll keep you up to date on this. I just really wanted to take a little bit more of a chance to expand on that idea and let our listeners know where that's really coming from, because we've heard some media coverage, both Casey and I have heard some media coverage that hasn't really been accurate in terms of the rule of law and what the real issue is here. So we'll keep you updated on this, but we are going to have to take a break. We'll be back after our sponsors' messages right after this.
Now back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I hope you enjoyed those commercials. I always enjoy them so much. It's a nice little break. Actually, I don't listen to them at all, but, you know, you got to say that because I think they're the ones that paid to make this radio station do what it does, which is provide you quality entertainment day and night, 24 hours a day. But seriously, getting back to some of the biggest stories that came out this year in our end-of-year edition of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey, I'd like to talk a little bit more and just give you an update on a big story that really wasn't so much big news as it was a commemoration of the way in which our legal system recognizes the rights and needs of indigent people. Indigent people are those that don't have adequate financial resources to hire an expensive lawyer. And as we all know in our society, lawyers are people that expect to be paid pretty highly for what they do, perhaps on a par with doctors or other professionals that have gone through the process of earning a professional degree and then try to make up for the cost of obtaining that degree by charging for their services over the course of a career. That's something that can be problematic within our legal system, as has been a controversy about our healthcare system over the past few years, because, of course, we believe, and perhaps rightly so, that we are entitled to have access as citizens to that type of technology which can keep us alive, if so. If there is the medical equipment and the medical resources out there to keep somebody healthy, to extend one's life, and to treat disease, there is an argument that there's a moral obligation that we make that available to people who are living and not just to those who are rich and living. The same argument can be made for those who need access to the criminal defense or criminal justice system and have advocacy for them. In Wisconsin, we have a very, very low standard for what qualifies as indigency. And if a person has any form of assets whatsoever, meaning income, perhaps, and whether it be disability or whatever the case may be, having income is something which disqualifies a person from public defender representation. Also, if you have any assets in terms of owning a vehicle, owning a home, or having any equity in those matters. So really, an asset of any kind is something that would disqualify a person from having access to that system. Now, if you think about it, this is something that has been put in place primarily so that the Sixth Amendment does what it says it's supposed to do. In other words, providing quality legal services. Well, it doesn't say quality legal services. It just says representation. One, it cannot be forced to go into a situation where their freedom is at risk without representation as part of that process. So this year marked the anniversary of Gideon versus Wainwright. And there was really a nationwide recognition of the fact that this was a watershed moment in our legal system that provided that somebody who is indigent must be provided representation by the state. And prior to that time, it was only available in capital cases, in cases where somebody was facing the death penalty to the loss of their life as a result of the trial. That because of the fact that the Sixth Amendment applies to all criminal cases and not just those where there is the possibility of the death penalty, then the Supreme Court ruled in Gideon that anyone's entitled to have that representation provided to them. Because after all, the playing field is not level. Well, then it probably doesn't remain level today, but the dream of Gideon is that those who are in need of it most, those people that do not have a fund set aside for when they may be committing a crime, which, you know, I'm being facetious because people don't do that and you shouldn't do that. And if you are doing that, it's probably a much worse crime than the types of crimes that are represented by people in the public defender's office. But this is especially this time of year, as we give thanks to those things that are important in our society, in our life. And I don't care if you are a law enforcement officer, if you are conservative or liberal, if you're a judge, if whoever you are, we all owe together a debt of gratitude to those people that work for the public defender's office. These people are faced with an unpopular task. Oftentimes they have to deal with people that need them greatly, and we count on them to stand in the way of a conviction when somebody is innocent of what they've been accused of. That's really one of the biggest problems in our society in terms of why we don't afford adequate funding. And I'm going to segue here into, even though Gideon says that we need to provide that representation, doesn't talk about how good that representation should be. And the noble people that become part of the public defender's office and whatever state or jurisdiction in the United States we're speaking of, they still face tremendous challenges based on the lack of resources that are allocated to them. And you have to imagine that when law enforcement and when prosecutors are approaching the legislators for more funding and more programs they want to do and more things that they'd like to do to improve law enforcement, and rightly so, it's all being done at the same time when we in the defense community are asking for enough funding to make sure that the job gets done correctly. And legislators tend to not understand why that's important and why we need to have quality defense. But I'll tell you this, if we're going to be able to rely upon the integrity, the very heart and soul of our system, we have to make sure that convictions, when they occur, are correctly done. Because if we start having a system whereby the citizens of our country don't have faith in the outcome of a case anymore, and I'll tell you, there are a lot of people out there that already believe that, and it's not just a recent trend, but if enough of us don't believe that the criminal justice system serves the purpose for which it was created, in other words, to have just results in order to protect all of us, essentially, all of us as citizens, all of us that have those rights to make sure that they are real and that they are protected and exercised on a regular basis. If we don't believe that because we see the results coming down as being arbitrary, or if we presume that anybody who's accused of a crime is guilty and therefore should not, we shouldn't waste our taxpayer dollars and our taxpayer resources towards defense of these but probably guilty people, you know, that system is falling apart at that point. And it's very significant that when we speak of the presumption of innocence, it's more than just a procedure that's applied at trial. It means that in society and how we look at our criminal justice system, we start with that assumption that everyone, every single person charged or the subject of even an investigation is innocent. And the reason we need to do that is because, I'll reflect back on, when we are trying to improve or trying to adjust or trying to make sure that our legal system gets the best kind of results that we can all rely upon as a society, we have to remember that this is about innocent people. And we are all innocent. Everyone ever charged with a crime is innocent until and unless they can be proven guilty by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The wisdom of having it done in such a way as that ensures that we don't prejudge anybody. We don't allocate resources to one case because the person says he's innocent and not towards another because the person's confessed. It doesn't work that way. And when people try to boil it down like that, when people try and parse it out in such a way that, well, we're going to reserve funding for those cases where the people really need it because they're innocent. Well, we can't do that because we don't know who's innocent until the end of the process. So we presume, we assume, and we do that to protect all of us. We assume that people are innocent until proven guilty. Well, you might find it interesting that somehow I managed to incorporate the presumption of innocence, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the right to counsel, and Gideon versus Wainwright all within a 15-minute segment. But hey, that's why I'm on the radio, and that's why I do all the talking into this silly microphone. But we're coming up on the halfway point, and I did want to remind our listeners that as we go into 2014, we are going to be, as ever, able to respond to your questions, your comments, your inquiries, and you can feel free to email them to info, that's I-N-F-O, at kirkobear.com, spelled K-I-R-K-O-B-E-A-R.com. Send us your questions, your comments. We get a lot of fan mail. People tell us that they like the show, but you know, we'd like to see more ideas for topics that people would like to see covered. We do tend to try and make this a news program with commentary. And when Casey's here, anyway, we like to have the debate process go on. So instead, I'm left with arguing both points this particular episode, but we'll welcome Casey back next week for the next installment of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. But in the meanwhile, we're going to take a break and listen to our wonderful sponsors.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. Another big issue that came up this year as we do our end of year recap for 2013 was the big story that we covered involving Governor Walker's refusal to exercise executive clemency in any form in any case. Now, as an update to that, I think we can anticipate that 2014 may hopefully bring a different outcome to this type of story. And we're hoping that the influence that we have generated, and particularly Casey has generated with some of his media releases on this issue, will have that beneficial outcome by simply asking the governor to reconsider his position on having a blanket denial of all clemency petitions. To put it in simpler terms for our listeners, that means a pardon. And the pardon is something that is designed to operate as one of those checks and balances within our system. And as we all know, if you paid attention anyway in your government class or your civics class when you were younger, you know, I did. I tried to. I took notes, at least when I wasn't daydreaming about being in the Beatles or something. And by the way, that never happened, so I'm glad I did pay attention in civics class, because if I hadn't and I fulfilled those dreams of somebody being in the Fab Four, which frankly would have been impossible because I was only 4 years old when they broke up. But point is, you have the pleasure of listening to me, and I have the pleasure of talking to you over the airwaves now, because I was not in the Beatles. Isn't that amazing? So anyway, back to this issue. The three branches of government and the way that they work hand in hand and against each other is part of what we're talking about here, because we have the legislative branch, which creates the laws based on the will of the people. So people are supposed to say, "Dear Mr. or Mrs. Legislator, I would like to have a law that makes this happen or prevents this from happening or makes something else easier, etc." And then that law is drafted, voted upon, and then sent to the executive branch. Remember, I'm just a bill on Capitol Hill, that whole thing. So when we are in the process of trying to get a bill going up to the governor, well, the governor can then veto or approve, and in some jurisdictions there can be line item vetoes where it doesn't necessarily have to be the entire thing that is approved, and there can be sections of it. But in the midst of how laws then are implemented and how they are given their actual weight is that they are enforced. They're enforced through the executive branch after it has left the legislative branch, and a bill is now within the executive system. Now, on behalf of the executive, we have the Department of Justice. So the governor basically appoints a head of the Department of Justice. That person or persons then supervise the administration of justice throughout the state. So that's why we have district attorneys that are elected in each individual jurisdiction. Primarily, it's based on counties. So we have, actually, I believe we have 71 district attorneys, even though we have 72 counties, because there is one district attorney that covers two counties. But I may be wrong about that. It's something like that. But that then is the interaction between now the executive portion of the government, which is implementing and executing, if you want to say, the laws that have been drafted by the legislature and in turn from the people. Now it goes into court, and this is where the judicial function of the government then reviews and makes sure that everything's being done properly based on the execution of the laws drafted by the representatives of the people. So one thing that happens, though, is that in the process of a case working its way through the system, it gets charged initially, someone faces criminal charges, and in this context, that's what we're talking about, and then the case goes to trial. The person defends him or herself based on either the public defender's office or hiring private counsel, and if the person is convicted, what happens then is that the judicial portion of the government then implements the conviction and the sentence. And so now the judicial function of government takes over as it relates to the disposition of the actual application of a law against an individual person. And there is a review process that remains within the judicial function of the system, which we all know of as the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, and so on. But one thing that the general public may not understand about this, and it would appear that Governor Walker doesn't understand about this, and I'm sure he does understand it, he's just not willing to listen to it this way, is that when you have a petition, and when you appeal something, appeal a conviction to the Court of Appeals, it is not a function of the judicial portion of government to say that you would like to have the case reversed because of good behavior or because of successfully achieving rehabilitation or because of positive community service. No, those are not things that you can tell the Court of Appeals have made a difference in a person's life. What you can argue in the Court of Appeals is that the judge below did something wrong by ruling a particular way, or that the prosecutor engaged in some kind of misconduct. But what happens to the person and their life afterwards is not relevant at any point in the proceedings up until, and this is why this is important, it is presented to the executive in our state. That's the governor. It could be the president of the United States if we're talking about federal jurisdiction, but in our state, it is, we have a procedure built into place where those things are important and those things do matter. So in the particular individual's case that we've been covering and discussing over the course of the past several months, a Marine Corps veteran of many years who served honorably in our overseas in Afghanistan and Iraq, ends up in a situation where he throws one punch in a bar fight, and it ended up being charged as and being ultimately dispensed with as a felony conviction, which we could argue, well, why did that happen? That doesn't seem like it should be a felony. But regardless of how or why or when it occurred in the way that it did, lo and behold, this gentleman has a felony conviction for doing something that I think we see on TV and in movies and don't regard as that serious all that much. And again, I'm not making light of the situation, but we assume in life that your entire existence on this planet should not be defined by one moment, one decision. Now, if it results in somebody dying, and if that one decision was something that has catastrophic effects, then yeah, you do end up having your life defined by that one moment. But in the normal day in, day out existence that we're hoping our criminal justice system can address, and our day-to-day lives and how we brand each other and how we end up treating each other in society. There is that line in the sand that if you are a convicted felon, you don't get the same respect, you don't get the same rights as anybody else. And it doesn't matter if 99.9% of your life has been spent doing good deeds and you found yourself in the wrong place at the wrong time in a bar, not doing anything wrong, but there's a mutual affray going on, you end up in the middle of it, boom. That defines your life. You're no longer an honorable veteran of our armed forces. Now you're a convicted felon. You know, it goes back to my earlier segment here about why it's important that we respect the Gideon versus Wainwright dream to have people given adequate representation. And a lot of people have said, well, how does this guy end up with a felony conviction if that's all he did? Well, you know, there are problems within our system that can certainly result in that. There are people that get convicted of crimes that are more serious than what they've actually done, and that happens practically on a daily basis. Now, getting back to why this is really ultimately the governor's responsibility, there is no process by which someone can say, look, the impact of being a convicted felon in my particular situation is unjust, and I can help society, I can help my country, I can help my family, I can help the state of Wisconsin do better and be better by simply not having this conviction on my record anymore. And that is built into the system. And it's a place where someone should review, should at least look at such an application. And refusing to do so, I mean, I look at it like this. Let's say you're at the Kentucky Derby and all the horses are racing and it comes down to the wire and that the only person who's capable of making the photo finish decision is the Grand Marshal of the Derby, and there is a photograph that's taken and you have to decide whether, you know, horse number one or horse number four crossed the line first. And the marshal says, well, I'm not going to do that because I have decided that I will never look at such a photograph, such a photo finish, because I don't know why I decided this. I'm just not going to fulfill my duty because I have some philosophical difference. I don't believe in cameras. I don't believe in technology. I don't believe that the human eye should be questioned in any way, because after all, if the human eye can't tell which horse came in first, why should we look beyond that? And, of course, I'm making the analogy to if the court system convicts somebody, why should anybody question the finality of that? Frankly, it's ludicrous. So we hope that the governor does change his mind soon, not just for this particular case, but just in general. Appoint a pardon committee, pardon commission, at least look at these cases, at least just do your job and don't turn a blind eye to the possibility that someone deserves clemency sometime in the future. Well, we have to take a break, and we'll be back right after these messages with the final segment of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome to the final segment of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey, the final segment of the year 2013. And we're going to kick off next year with more of your favorite legal commentary show. Wanted also to remind our listeners that very soon you'll be able to obtain episodes of our show, Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey, on iTunes. And, of course, you can obtain them at the WHBL or any Midwest Communications Media Center website throughout 16 stations throughout the state of Wisconsin and potentially coming to other states in the near future. So we enjoy doing the show, and we hope that you enjoy listening to it. I wanted to continue with just a few more comments about the Governor Walker situation and his responsibility, really, to look at clemency petitions when submitted. And I want to read some commentary that's been posted on the internet on various different sites, and just to educate our listeners a little bit more about the background behind this. But as we said before, this young Marine veteran, his name is Eric Pizer, P-I-Z-E-R, He was seeking, is in the process of seeking a pardon from Governor Walker, hoping that it would be considered. Of course, the governor's response was that no pardons will be considered on the belief that convictions stand for what they are, and that is a final resolution of the case that results in somebody being a convicted, in this case, felon. But this is a comment that I've seen recently. I'll just read it to you. It says, either Governor Walker is rejecting pardons categorically as a matter of self-interest, that is, protecting himself from a Willie Horton ad, which could surface when he runs for president or re-election as governor, or he has a philosophical reason to do so. In either case, it's unknown if the defense bar can do much about it. And this comes from an individual in the defense bar. But a suggestion was made here that I'd like to share with our listeners. This person wonders if it would be possible to have an elected, quote-unquote, pardoner, whose job it would be to evaluate and process pardon sentence modification requests from any given geographic area. People could elect judges and a pardoner who could effectively trump the judges in answer to the people via periodic elections. Are there too many pardons? Well, the judges and prosecutors could squawk at the pardoner, who might face a challenger and then lose his job. Too few pardons for what the people want? Again, the elected pardoner might face a challenge. Such a system could lead to many more pardons, though there could be the ugliness to it, as it would make crime and forgiveness more political than it already is. So, interesting point here, but again, I think it's more a matter of highlighting why it is that the governor has a particular problem philosophically or fear-based, and that was really the implication of the comment that I just read, is that one who says that he will not pardon anybody essentially is taking the safe road so that he doesn't run into any kind of opposition based on, and when we say Willie Horton, we all know what we mean, a Willie Horton situation where somebody pardons an otherwise, you know, a person regarded as a criminal, and then that gets used against that person when they're running for president or whatever. And I think we've all seen the writing on the wall that that's perhaps something that's being anticipated from the governor's camp. And all I can say is if Governor Walker, if that's the reason why you will not consider a pardon in any case, is because you want to prevent your political opponents from citing to cases where you administer a pardon, when you hope to make that run for the right White House, well, then shame on you, because that's selfish and that's not the way that the system should work. When you are an executive and you exercise executive power, part of that involves sticking your neck out and making the right decisions. You can't insulate yourself from making, at least considering. And frankly, I don't think the people of this state care if you denied every single pardon. It's just that you won't even look at them. You won't even go through the process of appointing a commission, as is your duty to do, in order to respond to these types of things. But I would encourage, if this is something you care about, say something about it. Write something in the newspaper. And if it's not political, this is not a political discussion. This has to do with the integrity of our justice system and whether or not you as a citizen believe that there is a piece of it that shouldn't be functioning or utilized. So if you have something to say about it, I'd encourage you to do so. Now, along the same lines of what we've been talking about, there has been quite a bit of uproar regarding the possibility that somebody who is innocent yet convicted could still lose out on that last chance, in this case, perhaps an executive clemency petition that could be granted. And we've seen yet another year in 2013 where a surprisingly, and I would say shockingly, embarrassing number of convictions have been overturned based on what we now know to be wrongful convictions, based on either faulty evidence, just or made up evidence, based on the fact that the prosecutors will perhaps sometimes unknowingly offer perjured testimony. I mean, a prosecutor is not supposed to knowingly do that because there are laws against that. But because of the way that evidence is created in our system, and I'm sorry, although I do now watch CSI, or what is, Casey, what's the show I watch? You're not here, so I can't ask you, but you know what I watch. Oh, Law & Order, that's the one. See, he's communicating with me via ESP. Thank you, Casey. It's Law & Order. I enjoy that show, but not because it has an accurate reflection of our legal system or what it does or should look like. In fact, it's downright silly how a case gets investigated, goes to trial, and then there's a verdict all within the course of an hour, minus time for commercial breaks. But the thing that makes the show interesting is not its relationship to reality. It's more a matter of how you can see that this is a formula for storytelling. And if you look at the structure of Law & Order, and again, the reason I enjoy it is because at roughly 18 minutes, the show, the detectives in the show would have you believe that they've got their man, and the case is going to get wrapped up and solved, and then we're going to go to trial, they'll get convicted. But then after the commercial break at the roughly the halfway point, something changes, and then you've got a different suspect that casts doubt onto your original suspect. And then towards the end of the show, it almost always comes back to something that happened in the beginning that changes everything. So this is a formula, and it's a good formula because it's one of those things where we've figured out how to entertain people, how to utilize suspense and that kind of stuff. But I'll tell you, incorporating suspense and drama into real life when we're talking about the investigation of and potential conviction of people, real people, not actors or characters, you should not have those different elements built into the system. So what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is that there is this dream, this idea of an adversarial system somehow working and finding the truth. This tug of war that we envision our criminal justice system being, so that if the prosecution has their team of people pulling on one end, well, the defense, you get to put your hands on the rope and pull back. And if you're strong enough, then you either have a tie or you win the tug of war. But everything that happens as part of our justice system and every element that's added to that mix is something that is done in this adversarial context. Again, in the belief that the right outcome will somehow be driven by the tug of war. You know, it's sort of like in ancient Rome when they believed that if a man was strong enough to defeat a lion in an arena, then that made him, you know, somehow they would spare his life only to fight another lion and be killed by that one. So it doesn't really give you any sense of what the person is or who they are or what the case is all about when you have this adversarial process. And I've mentioned this before, and I, you know, we're all making New Year's resolutions. My resolution is going to be to try harder and to get some more work done on the book that I'm writing about restorative justice programs and how they could be more effectively utilized and implemented in our country. Rather than just relying upon good old-fashioned tug-of-war, we should look at how cases can be resolved without implementing a punitive component in every single case. We've all seen cases that are ideal candidates for this type of resolution process, and because of the nature of our tug-of-war, you know, people that should be talking to each other can't. People who would like to apologize to each other can't. People that would like to work on healing and mending wounds that are there where people could be on the same page can't, because the lawyers are driving the train. The lawyers are making the process go how that they want it to go based on fighting for their respective clients. Now, in a system whereby we could modify that somewhat and have people voluntarily participate in a restorative justice or alternative resolution process, we could have a win-win scenario. Other countries are doing this. Other states are experimenting with this process so that we don't just have the, you know, the tug of war. So how do we do that? How do we change people's ideas behind this? I'll tell you, we take a step backwards in this evolution every time we treat the justice system as some way of retribution or getting back at somebody else. Let's say that you or a family member is a victim of a crime. The justice system is not there to make you feel better. It simply isn't. It's there to deal with the conduct, to deter others from it, but it's not there to help you as a victim feel any better, because that would be silly anyway. You're not going to feel better. There isn't anything that the judge or the prosecutor can do to help alleviate the real pain that you may feel. But in a restorative justice scenario, there are ways in which the human element of these types of things that can actually have positive change for the future, and actually significantly reduce recidivism, are things that can be utilized. Well, on that note, on perhaps a high note with hope for greater peace and prosperity in our state and throughout the country, I bid you farewell, 2013, and we'll see you next year with Legal Defense, Kirk and Casey. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your weekend.